Welcome to the 2018 U.S. Proxy Season Preview. I'm Kern McPherson, Senior Director of North American Research for Glass Lewis, and I'm joined today by three of my colleagues. I'll let them introduce themselves.
Thanks, Kern. I'm Courtney Keating. I am the Director of Environmental, Social, and Governance Research.
Hi, my name is Crystal Milo, and I am the Director of U.S. Research.
Hello, everybody. I'm Julian Hammond. I'm the Director of Executive Compensation Research for Glass Lewis.
Today, we're looking ahead to the 2018 proxy season, and I'll be asking Courtney, Julian, and Crystal to discuss the key topics affecting Glass Lewis's research and recommendations in the coming year, with a special emphasis on corporate culture, ESG, board accountability, and engagement. To set the stage a little bit, 2017 was a momentous year in the world of corporate governance. We observed a growing emphasis on investor stewardship as a global phenomenon, with the proliferation of investor stewardship codes around the globe, and the formation of the ISG in the United States, a group whose corporate governance principles officially went into effect this January. Issues of gender equality, climate change, and corporate behavior were frequently front page news and front of mind for many investors in 2017. The political climate in the United States throughout 2017 was tense, with a concerted push for broad deregulation standing in contrast to a growing emphasis on corporate responsibility. In an open letter to public company CEOs, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink called on companies to serve a greater purpose beyond profits on the balance sheet, one that benefits a greater good for all stakeholders. Let's start by talking about corporate culture, and I'll turn to Courtney first. Courtney, we've seen a number of high-profile corporate scandals in recent years in which company culture was a key factor. And we've seen the spotlight being cast on issues of sexual harassment and corporate sales practices. Are shareholders looking more closely at corporate culture?
Absolutely, Kern. I would say that Wells Fargo was one of the biggest meetings of 2017. It was largely as a result of the sales practices that were, you know, so problematic within the company's culture, and the incentives that were a bit misaligned with the company's ultimate goals. And I would say that, you know, this has kind of been spurred on by the Me Too movement, which you referenced, and, you know, focus on human capital management, gender equality, and really workplace rights. Recently, there's been a coalition formed called the Human Capital Management Coalition. It's a group of investors who've recently petitioned the SEC to require more disclosure or to give guidance on more disclosure concerning these issues. And we're also seeing different pushes from, you know, different shareholder proponents and other kind of movements. For example, issues of gender pay equity have been really, really big over the last several years, and there was a majority-supported proposal asking for eBay to disclose this information in 2016. I think that this is going to continue to grow, and I think that investors are going to continue to be pushing on companies to ensure that there's board accountability for the company culture and that they're really managing the risks that are inherent in having a workforce.
Mm-hmm. Now, on this topic of board accountability, the New York City Comptroller, Scott Stringer, and the New York City Pension Funds launched the National Board Accountability Project version 2.0 in September last year. And they're targeting boards of over 150 U.S. companies and asking them to provide enhanced disclosure about gender, race, and ethnicity of the board members, as well as detailed information about each director's skills and experience. How is Glass Lewis addressing the topic of board diversity?
It's definitely a front of mind issue for us. It's something that's come up in almost all of our engagements within the last year. And it's something that I think, you know, along with us, our clients are very concerned about ensuring. So it's something that we've noted for a number of years. But in 2018, we're going to ensure that we're noting instances where companies do not have any women on their boards. And then beginning in 2019, if companies don't have have a kind of credible plan or don't have a really good explanation as to why they don't have any women on their boards, we may consider withholding from the chair of the Nomination and Governance Committee or from the entire committee.
So last I checked, there were only three companies in the S&P 500 that had all male boards. Mm-hmm. So it's clear to me that boards with no women are increasingly the outliers, particularly at the larger market cap companies.
Absolutely. I think that this may disproportionately affect smaller companies who have not necessarily paid the type of attention that the larger companies have to this issue. I think that, you know, we're not the only ones looking at this. A number of large investors, including BlackRock and State Street, have been pushing companies to ensure that they've got adequate gender representation. So I think, you know, we're kind of following suit of some very large asset managers who are very focused on this issue.
Yeah, and to tag on to the discussion about the accountability project version 2.0 with the skills matrix, you know, Glass Lewis, we're not looking whether or not a company has it or doesn't. You know, companies actually for years have been using skills matrix to evaluate their boards and to determine the gaps that they need, be it diversity or skills. You know, we see the skills matrix as a way for companies to engage with their shareholders and to disclose the type of discussions and the thought process they have in looking at board composition.
Great. Another one of the skill sets that Board Accountability 2.0 seeks to identify is environmental science, policy, and regulation. Courtney, can you describe how investors' views are evolving on the topic of climate change?
Sure. They're evolving rapidly, I would say, particularly as we're starting to kind of more acutely feel the effects of climate change through things like recent storms and, you know, through regulations, global and local, you know, trying to curb the effects of climate change. The board competency, you know, climate competency at the board level is definitely something that has come into focus for a number of investors. Almost every company is likely to be affected by a changing climate, whether it be physical risks, whether it be commodity risks, whether it be supply chain risks, or regulatory risks for companies like utilities or energy companies. So I think it's incumbent upon boards to ensure that they've got the right expertise, to ensure that they understand kind of the risks facing their company and how they can mitigate those risks. It's definitely been a focus of investors. And it's also been a focus of certain reporting mechanisms that have recently come into vogue, namely the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, or TCFD. One of the kind of four big pillars of the TCFD is governance of climate change. So it's definitely top of mind for, you know, not only kind of reporting frameworks, but investors as well. And I think this is really evidenced through several very, very significant votes in 2017. The shareholder proposals at ExxonMobil, at Occidental Petroleum, and at PPL Corp all received majority shareholder support. And prior to 2017, we had never seen majority shareholder support for any of these types of resolutions. So it's going to be interesting to see how these companies respond. A number of them have already put out reports, and companies that didn't even receive majority support have been responding in kind with fairly significant reporting on climate change, things including 2-degree scenario analysis, stranded asset risk, you know, kind of really enhanced reporting. So it'll definitely be a momentous year for climate reporting, and I'm excited to see what companies do in that regard.
Great. So in addition to environmental-related or climate-related proposals, do other ESG topics intersect with executive compensation program design at all?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at executive compensation design, it really is a way of how companies incentivize behavior. And I think that in recent years, investors are really concerned that companies are ensuring that executives are incentivized towards, you know, more sustainable business practices. So we've seen a number of shareholder proposals that are really targeted at the metrics that companies are using in their executive compensation plans. So for example, we saw a shareholder proposal requesting that an oil company remove reserve metrics from their compensation plan so that they're not incentivized to kind of continue to drill. We're also seeing proposals this year that are aimed at pharmaceutical companies. So those companies involved in the manufacture, distribution, and treatment of opioids. It's been a very big issue for a number of investors and clearly for society as a whole, given the detrimental effects of the opioid epidemic. And investors are looking to these companies to ensure that their executive compensation plans are aligned with kind of society's broader goals to not kind of further spur on this epidemic.
And Courtney, since we're talking about intersections, I think addressing the issue from the say on pay side as well might make some sense here. So I absolutely agree with what Courtney's been saying, that ESG issues are making a bigger and bigger impact in executive compensation programs. So first off, that means that we're seeing more metrics, or at least a consistency of metrics like OSHA-related safety and carbon emissions in incentive plans. But a place where we're seeing even more growth in terms of this focus is on the list of things that the company considers when the board is evaluating holistic performance. Now, there's definitely been a lot of pushback in recent years against upward discretion, where the committee can increase payouts for executives. But more and more companies have been clear about factors that might lead the committee to reduce payouts for executives. Factors like diversity, racial, gender, or other environmental matters in particular are explicitly making the list of what a board might look at and say the calculated financial metrics don't tell the whole story here, and we think the executive payout should be less. I think the other thing that I'd love to echo from Courtney's point is that metrics selection is becoming increasingly important. We're seeing fewer and fewer companies just say we're going to look at a revenue metric without kind of explaining why that's necessarily the best driver of overall company performance. And I think some of the new focus on return metrics and economic profit type metrics is definitely going to show that companies are trying to incentivize not just the returns, but the returns that are intended to kind of grow the business in the way that it needs to grow. The last thing I'd say, kind of underscoring both of those points, is that clawback policies, while still not necessarily a finalized issue from a regulatory standpoint, are becoming much more and more important. Using the same example that Courtney brought up of Wells Fargo, I think that metric selection and clawbacks can both be important considerations, and it's been definitely a case that put a ton of additional emphasis on both of those particular features as a facet of compensation.
Great. Thanks, Julian. Now let's stay on this topic of executive compensation for a few minutes. Julian, I understand one of the first big shareholder votes coming up is the special meeting of Tesla. Right?
That is correct. The Tesla pay package was disclosed a few weeks ago, even before any official filings, and it's been generating an enormous amount of buzz. Now, Tesla's entire approach here has been describing it as a high-risk, high-reward arrangement for something of a moonshot that they've been targeting, and it's really hard to argue with either side of that characterization. Tesla has been targeting growth levels that are higher than many, if not any, other public companies, especially given in the blue-chip range, and the dollar values associated, along with the potential dilution and this sheer time horizon of the award, are far in excess of what we'd see at almost any other company. So I'm very curious to see kind of how the market is going to respond to these. But from our perspective, because of that all or nothing status, it's a lot harder for the compensation committee to make year over year tweaks. We saw some difficulty with this from the 2012 grant as it related to the production milestones, given some of the delays that Tesla's seen with the Model 3. But that longer time horizon and the kind of more fixed nature of what they're trying to achieve means that if the plan is not designed right in every capacity, then it can cause enormous headaches for shareholders and for the company further down the road. So our task is going to be to look at all of the nuts and bolts of this enormous, complicated proposal to see whether or not there are too many negative potential outcomes for our clients.
Now, Elon Musk is a big name, a big celebrity status. Does that affect the size of the grant?
Absolutely. One of the main factors kind of underscoring a lot of, at least some CEO compensation is that the uniqueness of the individual. And going into the 2018 season, I think one of the big themes we're going to see is that there is going to be a lot of big changes at big companies involving big personalities. So just looking at the last few months, we've seen a lot of big news come out about folks who are more or less eponymous with the businesses they ran. Meg Whitman of the HP companies, Bob Iger of Disney, and for better or worse, Steve Wynn, all of those names are at least engaged in some type of transitional or severance negotiations. And what's going to happen from those is something that we've been paying very close attention to.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of big name CEOs, one of the regulations that goes into effect this year are the disclosure rules surrounding the CEO pay ratio. How will you be treating that pay ratio figure this year?
The pay ratio figure is going to be a really interesting one, but I think given the wide range of potential methodologies a company could use and the SEC's kind of flexibility in assessing it and accounting for reasonable methodologies, we're looking at it as more of a curiosity. Maybe down the road, there's going to be some really meaningful insights that we can draw from maybe longitudinal or year-over-year comparisons in that figure, or maybe the performance of that metric in specific sectors. But as it stands, we haven't found a concrete way of looking at a given data point for a given company and being able to make a concrete claim about what that says about corporate governance or the company's overall status.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Now, whether or not the CEO pay ratio has a direct impact on shareholders' voting decisions remains to be seen. But I think it can certainly become a point of dialogue between companies in their engagements with shareholders. I'd like to stay on this topic of engagement, and I'll turn to Crystal now. Now, Crystal, in his letter, Larry Fink states that, quote, "The time has come for a new model of shareholder engagement, one that strengthens and deepens communication between shareholders and the companies they own." Crystal, how do Glass Lewis's engagement efforts fit into this new model of shareholder engagement?
Great. Well, you know, in the past 2 years, we've been very proactive in our shareholder engagement efforts. In the past year, we've engaged with 1,500 companies globally, which is up 50% from what we did in the past year. We feel like this initiative that we're taking helps to improve transparency and provides an opportunity for us to explain our policies to public companies, and again helps to put our into context our policies with public companies, and it allows such companies to speak to us about and explain their situation. Engagement is particularly important, I guess, for our passive investors who don't necessarily have the opportunity to divest, and therefore engagement is their one way to kind of share concerns with management.
Crystal, how has that dialogue that you're having with companies evolved in recent years?
It's evolved tremendously. I'd say 5 years, we were talking about the split between chairman and CEO, and then it evolved to talking about pay topics. And now shareholders are a lot more concerned. Well, you know, they're still concerned about pay topics, but they really are concerned about board composition. And this is not just about diversity, but diversity of thought and the type of skills and skills gaps that and how the company is approaching it.
Now, are you also talking to companies about, or have you gained a sense of how public companies' engagement programs have changed over time?
Yes, definitely. Companies, years before, were only speaking to about their top 10% of shareholders, and now they're talking about talking to 30, 40, even 50% of the shareholder base. So it's really expanded to speak to a lot of their shareholders and not just their top ones. You know, other topics that they continue to talk about are, again, what we spoke about earlier was diversity, but not just whether or not there's a woman on the board, but how are they getting to that? What is their director search? How are they addressing diversity within the company and their hiring practices? These are all things that are continue to be important, and you know, there's just not enough room in the proxy statement to talk about this. And so, again, these engagements for us really help to put in context of the real challenges in the boardroom that we just don't get insight to when we read the proxy statement.
Mm-hmm. And I think it also gives an opportunity for companies to you know, to tell their story, and also to show how they're being responsive to last year's vote results. Now, on the topic of responsiveness, the first principle in the ISG's corporate governance framework is that boards are accountable to shareholders. Another principle is one vote, one share. Courtney, how are you addressing this concept of dual class shares?
Absolutely. I think since the Snap IPO, this has really come into the spotlight, and investors are paying a lot closer attention to it. And I would say that Glass Lewis is no exception. You know, during the 2018 season, we've strengthened our language around dual class shares, and we're going to be more closely scrutinizing dual class share structures, particularly when companies IPO with unequal voting structures. In addition to that, we're also going to be looking closer at the vote results at dual class share companies or companies with unequal voting rights. We want to know how unaffiliated shares are voting, and you know, we may consider taking some sort of action if a majority of shareholders, of unaffiliated shareholders, have indicated that they feel a certain way about a director election, a say on pay result, or a shareholder proposal, and the company has not taken any appropriate action.
Great. Now, let's talk about how some of these topics will be addressed through the Glass Lewis policy guidelines for 2018. Mm-hmm. Crystal, do you want to talk about the changes that you made for 2018?
Sure. So just to reiterate what Courtney was talking about, we've strengthened the language of the dual class, and particularly scrutinizing IPOs with unequal voting. We talked about gender diversity in that in this year, we will be highlighting companies that don't at least have one woman on the board. Another hot topic that's out there is the virtual shareholder meetings. We've seen an uptick in that. We're expecting at least 200 companies this year to hold a virtual shareholder meeting, in which a number of them have gone away with the in-person meeting. And so while we're not particularly going to have any recommendations for or against, what we're looking for these virtual shareholder meetings are safeguards. We want to be ensured that they are inclusive of all shareholder base and are responsive to a shareholder concern. And we'd say, in particularly for companies that had maybe a tumultuous year, that they opt for an in-person meeting. And last, we have adjusted our materiality threshold, and this particularly pertains to Director of Elections and Say on Pay.
Julian, I'm turning to you now. What changes were made for 2018 with regard to executive compensation?
So like I said earlier, there's not been a lot of major seismic shifts in either compensation practices or our approach to it. The pay ratio is going to be one kind of an unknown variable and how it's going to be interpreted by the market. And for that reason, we're going to be keeping close tabs on it and displaying it when we can for companies. Now that said, a lot of what we've been doing is the same year over year. We still endorse robust clawback policies beyond the legal minimum. We still take a very careful level of scrutiny to any one-time awards outside of the regular plan, and we are still very, very leery of any steps backward in compensation plan design. That said, though, in our most recent guideline update, we did offer a few clarifications, most particularly that a C grade under our pay-for-performance analysis is actually middle of the road as opposed to the regular school letter systems where a C grade is passing or barely passing. So that clarification should address a lot of questions we get regarding that particular evaluative test. But again, we're just trying to keep an eye on all of the different trends and address the issues as they come up for given companies.
Great. And Courtney, how about the shareholder initiative guidelines?
Sure. We haven't made any really sweeping changes, but we did kind of codify our language around certain climate change reporting proposals, and we did give reference to the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, which I referenced earlier, just to kind of say that we're going to review proposals requesting that companies adopt that reporting framework on a case-by-case basis, you know, considering their industry, history and the kind of market response to that reporting framework. In addition, we've also codified our policies on fix-it proxy access shareholder proposals. So these are proposals that are targeted at companies who have already adopted a proxy access bylaw, and they're asking the companies to kind of tweak these proposals on the margins, so allowing a larger group of shareholders to nominate a director, or allowing shareholders to nominate a larger proportion of the board. In situations where we see these types of proposals, we're going to look very closely at the company's existing proxy access bylaw, and in instances where we can identify especially restrictive language or provisions that shareholder unfriendly, we may consider supporting these resolutions.
Great. Well, before we wrap up, I'd like to ask each of you, what is one upcoming shareholder meeting that you're really on the lookout for this year?
Well, I think everybody's eyes are going to be on Exxon, so they can see how shareholders respond to the recent climate reporting that they put out that I referenced earlier. And also, I'd be remiss to not mention Wells Fargo's upcoming meeting, in which four directors will be removed from the board. So it'll be interesting to see which directors those are. And also, it'll be interesting to see how shareholders will respond to the company's actions, particularly in light of the Fed recently placing restrictions on their asset growth. But the meeting I'm most looking forward to is Wynn. It'll be interesting to see kind of first what Steve Wynn's payout will look like in light of his departure. And it'll also be interesting to see how the board will respond and how shareholders will respond to issues that have been highlighted concerning the company's culture and the claims of sexual harassment therein.
Great. Crystal?
This year, I'm definitely looking to see what happens at the Equifax annual meeting. The growing demand for cybersecurity skills on board and the changes they had made in the past year, you know, it'd be interesting to see how shareholders react to those actions.
Mm-hmm. Julian, how about you?
Well, beyond the obvious interest in the Tesla meeting that's coming up in a few months, I'm very curious to see what's going to happen in terms of the market's response to Netflix. It's a little bit less of a major headline-grabbing issue than a lot of the other meetings we've talked about today, but they've made the very unusual step for a company that's doing well of removing the variable portion of the variable cash. Whether that's something that a lot of folks are going to have a strong feeling about is something that's an open question.
Great, and for myself, I always enjoy reading the GE proxy statement. They have exemplary disclosure. They have a difficult story to tell sometimes, but they do a good job of telling it. And then finally, I'm interested in the annual meeting for Mylan. They had a very low support for Say on Pay last year, so I'm curious to see what steps the board has taken in response to that. I want to thank everyone for listening. I'd like to remind public companies that are listening that the Glass-Lewis Issuer Data Report program is underway, and we are accepting signups now, but you need to sign up in advance of your meeting. To do so, go to meetl.com, that's M-E-E-T-Y-L.com, create a free login, and click Engage with Glass-Lewis, and that takes you right to the signup page.
This recording should not be considered a solicitation of proxies by Glass-Lewis. Glass-Lewis has not sought permission to do so from the SEC, nor will it. This recording is for information purposes only and should not be construed as providing investment advice. In addition, Glass-Lewis makes no representation regarding the accuracy, completeness, or reliability of any statement of any of our speakers in this recording. If you have any questions, please contact us via our website, www.glasslewis.com.